This is the Saturday to Sunday Football Podcast.
This is where it all counts. This is why we're here. This is why each one of us are here.
And now, here's your host.
Welcome back to another edition of the Saturday to Sunday Football Podcast. And I am Paul Perticchese, and thank you for joining me. As always, the NFL draft is just a little over 2 weeks away. Here at Saturday to Sunday, we have been covering things wire to wire in preparations, ranking shows, tier buster shows, previewing it all out, discussing the rumors. But today we finally get to bring one of the best in the industry and pick their brain and hear their takes and talk about these prospects that I think make up a fascinating 2024 NFL draft class. I am talking about the one and only Mr. Matt Waldman. Matt, welcome back to the Saturday to Sunday Football Podcast. I know every year I say it. It's one of my favorite episodes. We do most times pre-draft, post-draft. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, same here, man. I always look forward to getting to talk shop with you, and I'm always glad that you get to join us on on the draft show that Sigmund Bloom and I do over at Football Guys. You know, you're such an asset for that. And, you know, the work that you guys do at Saturday to Sunday, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir, people who are listening, but if they're not subscribing to the work that you guys do, they're missing out. So, you know, thanks again for the privilege to be able to do this.
Absolutely. And thank you for the kind words as well. So let's jump right into this, because I feel like there's so many prospects I kind of want to pick your brain on. And let's start at the quarterback position. And I'm going to be a little selfish here. And I'm going to hone in on two guys that I think are polarizing players. And it seems like I can never get out as a Giants fan out of that quarterback, you know, purgatory since Eli Manning left. And let's start with what you see from Drake May and J.J. McCarthy. Those are two guys, and this isn't going to be a Giants, you know, podcast, you know, but these two guys are two guys that have been really discussed a lot at the top of the draft here in New York. They've been talked a lot about in terms of those are two guys that they might be interested in. You know, combing through your rankings a little bit, you definitely have some reservations, maybe more than some, in terms of development that those two prospects need, or maybe potential ceiling. So you could start with either one, just in terms of what you like about their game. What are areas that you think are really important that we need to see refinement? Do you think they should be thrown into the mix right away, or they would benefit from learning and sitting a little bit? Stuff like that.
Sure. I think anybody who I score on a 100-point scale in the RSP, and so for my pre-draft rankings, anybody, it's all based on the depth of talent score and that 0-100. Anybody who scores below an 80 for me is someone that ideally I would like to see them sit for some period of time. Ideally, I'd like to see them sit year one. The closer they are to 75, the closer they are to 80, the more I'm amenable to the idea that maybe they need to sit for part of the season, but not all of the season. So those two players, McCarthy and May, McCarthy for me, he scored as a 76.95, so nearly a 77. Kind of in the middle of that. Like, ideally, I'd like him to sit for most of the year. I think that would probably be good. Maybe the last 4 to 6 games, kind of like Desmond Ridder, I could see how that would be okay for him. I like his footwork. I think he has a really solid base for being able to throw accurate passes. His pocket movement and pocket management tend to be good. I think he knows how to step up in the pocket rather well. He doesn't invite too much pressure. He knows how to use his athletic ability in an efficient manner so that he's getting the ball out quickly and accurately, at least in the short and intermediate passing games. Where I have some issues with McCarthy, I think there are things that are correctable. I just think that it's a matter of whether or not he gets thrusted into a scenario where teams keep him in the lineup or keep him in games if he starts to struggle in the areas that I'm going to mention. One is the red zone. While he's good on third and fourth down, when you look at the accuracy percentages for that, his red zone decision-making repeatedly had issues in terms of forcing throws, not reading leverage well, missing drops of defenders in scenarios that he should not miss, not being willing to throw the ball away. Management things that plagued Mitchell Trubisky. those were really the differences between Mitchell Trubisky still being a starter and finding seeing his way out of Chicago. And it never changed, and it was that way at North Carolina for him. So McCarthy, I want to see that. And same with same issue with Trubisky also had was in the black zone, backed up in his own deep area. McCarthy shows that as well. And then the area that's kind of the unknown is how good is his vertical accuracy really? Because we didn't see a huge sample size of it. The sample size I saw wasn't very strong, but, you know, philosophically, when you're evaluating players as a scout, you have to ask yourself the question, am I going to give somebody credit and presume he can do something? Or am I going to presume that he can't do it and make him prove it? And just based on my background in operations and quality control type of work, you make them prove it, because otherwise, you know, you're assuming. It's nice in life to assume the best, but in terms of when there's things on the line, you presume that they can't do it till they say otherwise. So those three things, the red zone, the black zone, the vertical, you know, accuracy beyond 28 yards, those are things that either he has to prove that he can do better or and develop, or he has to prove that he can do it at all. And I think, oh, he was the toughest evaluation I had this year. He reminds me of a guy. He reminds me of guys like, not in terms of style necessarily, but maybe where they are in terms of their development, like Jake Plummer and Johnny Manziel and Drew Locke, like guys who sometimes take risks and it works out, but they may lean a little too hard on certain assets of their games that aren't going to project well to the NFL if they continue to do it with abandon. And so I see a little bit of that Jake Plummer where, or Johnny Manziel, where you look at their games and people go, oh, they're a little wild, and but they actually had some sort of technical underpinnings and conceptual underpinnings that made sense. But in Manziel, he just didn't want to be a pro football player and didn't want to work at it. And in Plummer's case, he just had too much of a wild air in his game. So that's my thought on McCarthy.
You want that before yeah, you jump over to Meg, quick question about McCarthy. I think my level of thinking, and I don't know how the NFL approaches this, and maybe just a general how you approach it if you were running a team. Even if he fixes the areas that you say, okay, they're potentially fixable in terms of development, maybe he sits the appropriate amount of time, and you know, if he hits in terms of developing that, I struggle. Is he a guy that can be a focal point of carrying an offense? And maybe that's, you know, is he Jared Goff, which is a good starting quarterback in the NFL? But I struggle as a Giants fan picking at the top of the draft. And I'm sure, you know, maybe Vikings fans who are thinking about moving up, or Broncos fans probably are asking the same question. Even if he hits, is that good enough? Or are we going to be here four or five years from now asking the question, he's good, but we're not. It's not good enough, and that's where I struggle about. Is the ceiling high enough for an early first round pick? Can you do you decipher between that? Like, if you were running a team, if he is Jared Goff in 4 years, is that good enough to make him an investment as early as it's probably going to take to get him? Or would you be like, man, that's more of the reason why I don't see him at that level of a guy that maybe invests at the top of the draft?
I don't think he's at that level, but he's at that Mason-Dixon line of it. For me, Goff is at that Mason-Dixon line, mm-hmm. where you look at him and you say, okay, I see the argument. Like, he's tough. He's mentally tough. He wasn't the reason the Lions didn't get to the Super Bowl, that's for sure. And I think that's part of it. But the problem is that in today's NFL, this is kind of where I look at it, is that I would like this quarterback class a lot more overall if the NFL actually had a clue about how to approach developing these guys. And I'm not saying my way would work, but I am saying that their way has shown that it hasn't. When you're at 33% or somewhere 38% or whatever low it is, anything well below 50 to 60 in developing guys, and they're not developing, they're just starting them and let them see where the chips fall. But to me, that's part of the problem, is that the, it seems like all the players we're talking about this year after year, and I know I've been talking about it for well over a decade, is that it'd be nice to see the Jordan Love plan enacted out with a lot of players, because we can list all these MVP and Pro Bowl caliber players who sat, whether it was by plan or it was because the team didn't believe in them, and then they had to use them and find that opportunity. And I think that McCarthy, most of the quarterbacks in this class need that time. So McCarthy, to me, as it stands right now, I mean, if we're going to say he corrects the things he does and proves that he can be a vertical thrower, I think he's just above that Mason-Dixon line, and that's good. If he doesn't prove that he's a good vertical thrower, a good intermediate to vertical thrower, and he does fix those things, he's just below that Mason-Dixon line for me. So it's kind of, I get the consternation about him in that regard. He's definitely not Zach Wilson 2.0 in terms of like the same, or I'd say Zach Wilson part two. He's not that, but he might be Zach Wilson 2.0, as in they finally got it right to actually see him as a, see this player as a capable starter who's not going to get in way over his head that people hyped up too much for reasons that just didn't make sense.
Yeah.
So there's that. So, yeah.
Let's pivot over to Drake May, another guy that I think very polarizing player. I think you see the highs and I think you see the lows when and anybody watches Drake May. And I think what has people intrigued is those highs of what he could be. Your feedback on, is it realistic or even correctable to get to maybe that level of player, or you are a little bit too concerned with the development needed and the flaws that maybe he currently possesses, that you think it's a little bit of a reach that he might be able to correct all the things that, that make him that inconsistent up and down player?
Well, I think that probably self-awareness is a good thing when it comes to scouting. And I would say, for anybody who isn't familiar with my work, I would probably equate myself to the anti-NFL establishment of quarterback evaluation. The guys that I loved were players like Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson. I liked Jared Goff. They did too, but then they abandoned real quick. And, you know, players of that sort, or, you know, I like Brock Purdy more than most, you know. But at the same time, I also like Skylar Thompson a lot, you know, compared to not liking Malik Willis or Desmond Ridder, or being like, yeah, Kenny Pickett's okay, but here's my big concerns about him by year two, year three. If he doesn't really show much, it's going to be over, you know. And what that means to me is this, is that the reason that I think people love Drake May is that the people who are part of the quarterback establishment for evaluation basically mean is that they've copied their heroes in evaluation in media, or whatever they've learned from people within the league, or had a cup of coffee, or even had a longer stint in the league, is that quarterbacks should look like the following players out of central casting. I call them robo quarterbacks that they roll off the assembly line every year. Tall, big, strong-armed, big school, big completion percentage, which is a box score stat, not an actual contextual stat to the level that people make it out to be, and having shown, you know, multiple years as a starter. The Bill Parcells shorthand from the 1980s and 90s and early 2000s, it's outdated now, bless them, you know. But really, those are all things that people say, you can't teach arm strength, you can't teach size, you can't teach these things, you can't teach winning, all that stuff. I'm going, that's great. Yeah, you're right. You can't teach that. But that's all baseline stuff. It's all baseline. And if all you're getting is the baseline, then you're never getting to develop player. What you really can't teach is processing speed. And that's what they're just figuring out. And they don't know how to test it yet. I mean, that's too, I'm glad they've come along. And hopefully they, and the other programs, they continue to work at that. But How quickly and confidently you process information is important. How well you manage a pocket is important. And these are things that can be taught early on as you're developing as a quarterback in Pop Warner, middle school, high school, maybe early college to an extent. And some players may, in very rare instances, can learn as they get older. But these are areas that things happen very quickly. And it's so the processing is ingraining complex information so that it's performed as simply and subconsciously, you know, as possible. It just looks at the kind of the speed of instinct, as Dan Hatman at the Scouting Academy would describe these things. And in order to do that, you have to really have worked at that the right way and gotten the right amount of experiences and time put into it on the field and away from the field. If you're going to try and do that now, like Daniel Jones in the pocket, you're probably going to have to strip his game down to the studs, give him a couple of years off the field, and then put him back on like Jordan Love got. You know, otherwise, it's already ingrained. It's hard to unteach that while you're working on the fly. And when I look at a player like Drake May, he's the robo quarterback who has toughness in the pocket. He'll take a hit just like Daniel Jones did. He'll make the big throws downfield just like Danny Dimes can do. You know, he's athletic, everything you're looking for, except that he's not as accurate as his heat maps say, because heat maps are completion percentage, just where the completion percentage happened. But completion percentage, like Baker Mayfield, like Drew Locke, like so many other players, is, and the corollary to that, Lamar Jackson, whose completion percentage sucked. But when you look at, when you actually chart games and you say, all right, what is an accurate pass, regardless of what the receiver did, regardless of whether it's a catch, no catch, was that accurate? Was it accurate because the coverage dictated a throw that was back shoulder or required an adjustment, and the ball was placed only where the receiver could catch it, and it was a reasonable opportunity for him to catch the ball that wouldn't be described as difficult? Because to me, a difficult catch is one that you don't expect the player to catch. A catch that you would expect them to catch, even if it's a harder catch to make because of the coverage, well, it's expected. So you're going to count some of those things. Look at Lamar Jackson, I go, his completion percentage may not have been good enough for the heat maps, but it was certainly very good enough for my charting. And when I look at Drake May, it's the opposite. His completion percentage was good, but when you look at the actual charting, it wasn't good. It was some of the worst I saw. Where in contrast, you know, I see some folks like Michael Penix, and or look at Michael Penix and say, it's bad. You know, whereas I'm looking at it, and from what I've charted, it was pretty darn good. So for me, Drake May has a lot of things that are hard to teach, and they're the things that already need to be learned at this point. And if they aren't, then he's going to need enough time to where he's not in a NFL pocket, getting pummeled, making slow and slower decisions, because now he's overthinking everything. And then the things he supposedly has ingrained are falling apart at the seams. And now he's playing even slower than we saw him at North Carolina, because this stuff happens. When you start to question yourself because of key things that you can't do well, the entirety of your game starts to slow down. When you are a Brock Purdy, let's say Mac Jones, that was Mac Jones. Brock Purdy, put him in an all-star lineup, and everything's happening the way that you theoretically should expect as a quarterback, and you have good processing speed to begin with, it doesn't slow down. It only speeds up. You only get more daring. You only have more positive reinforcement of things. So you go, oh, that's how it's supposed to be. This is easier. Then when the difficult situations come, you're not overthinking it. Whereas if you're Mac Jones after 2 years, now you're overthinking things that you never overthought at Alabama. And that's my fear with Drake May, is he's going to be coming to whoever he is, whoever the coach is, and it's going to be the Sam Darnold, Adam Gase show part two. I've seen ghosts. And Adam Gase is going, well, if you sniffed what I sniffed, you'd be wondering what I'm seeing too. You know, I'm too busy seeing some other things as opposed to ghosts. And I think that that's, he's going to get left in on the field, and he's going to wind up getting his tail kicked in, and it's going to slow his game down more. And you know, good luck to Sam Darnold. Hopefully he's a reclamation project that works out in Minnesota if they don't find themselves a quarterback but in this draft. But that's where we are, and that's where I think Drake May could wind up, is very much in the Sam Darnold scenario.
Yeah, and it's going to be fascinating with the teams that you hear potentially rumored for May. I mean, Minnesota might be one of those situations that maybe he would have that supporting cast to allow him to minimize early on those processing development needed. But if you throw him in New England or you throw him with the Giants and they still haven't fixed the O-line or Washington, I think that's where it's like, okay, this is going to open up that possibility, like you said, of more bad habits forming, not development forming that we need. And I think that's where, like you said, we see so many of these quarterbacks fail. It's like the hit rate shouldn't be that low at the highest level, with people literally investing their livelihood and endless amounts of hours and a team of people. But that's here we are.
It should be 65%. And I think I'm being conservative with that number, but you're absolutely right about that. And it's not that I dislike these quarterbacks. I dislike the NFL's ability to do anything with them to set them up for success. If the teams that were getting these quarterbacks were all Chuck Knoll, Marty Schottenheimer, even Jeff Fisher, who had Steve McNair, the way he worked with him and gave him intermittent starts or playing time with Chris Chandler in front and just gave packages to him. You know, if you had coaches like that in the NFL and owners who said it's okay for you to do that because I'm not a bunch of like the reality version of that fictional basketball coach for the Sixers in that that Adam Sandler movie Hustle that I saw on Netflix recently, you know, who's just like a born on third, you know, mm-hmm. Jeffrey Lannister version in real life, modern day version of that, then it would be different. But because teams would let these guys sit. And to me, anybody who was like above 75, I'd go, they could be a starter. You just need to give them the right environment and that will work. And while I say that I still feel that way, that it could happen in the right environment, I just don't believe the right environment is there more than maybe two times out of 30 at best.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of an issue at the level, and then teams are just so willing to move on so fast. Like, they're not even allowing guys to become backup quarterbacks at the NFL now. It's like we saw it this year. Like, how many teams took their former third round picks of like 2 years ago and just wanted to be done with them? Like,
what would have happened to Jordan Love? Yeah, what would have happened to him if he were a Cleveland Brown or a New York Jet or an Atlanta Falcon? We would not have seen this Jordan Love.
No, and it's just like, I would love to pick the brain of some of these, you know, these front offices. It's like, you took this guy in the third round. No one's taking anybody in the third round and is expecting greatness. So when you take, like, if you get lucky once in a while, sure, but you take a guy in the third round like Desmond Ridder or Matt Corral or, you know, other people. I think there was another one in that class I'm drawing a blank on, but I think it was three in the third round. And it was like, okay, you probably drafted him with the intent of hopefully to become a good backup. If you get lightning in a bottle, maybe they develop and they become a starter. They get thrown into the fire, fail, and it's like, we don't even want to consider you a backup anymore and develop you as maybe a backup quarterback on a rookie contract. We just want to be done with you. It's like, how is that? Like, that's now becoming like more of a norm with these teams. Just like, 2 years after drafting a quarterback, they just want to be done with that. Like, it's so weird where we know how hard it is to play quarterback and we know how much development is needed. It just seems a very backwards approach that instead of giving them that development, we're now rushing them and then discarding them basically at a more rapid pace than we've ever seen in the NFL.
And I think it has to do with two factors that aren't conspiring against each other intentionally. It's just unintentional blowback. One of them is that owners, like I talked about, Some of them can be kind of petulant and impulsive and impatient and want their way, and they're playing fantasy football with their team. And so they overrule what's actually reasonable, process-oriented sense with research, and they overrule it at the 11th hour, basically saying, I want this guy because I'm Bud Adams, and you know, the city of Houston kicked me out, so screw Jay Cutler. I'm gonna flip the bird at the city of Houston and get their guy Vince Young, when the whole team was lockstep otherwise on wanting Jay Cutler, other than Norm Chow, who wanted his guy Matt Leiden. You know, when you do that kind of thing, or you take Johnny Manziel, you know, after a workout where we've learned that the pro day his receivers were hungover. He was hungover. Receivers didn't even show up, couldn't even show up to practice, and they had students and accountants and marketing people catching footballs. I'm a Cleveland Browns scout. I don't believe for a minute. Maybe I'm wrong. And if their scouts did this, I apologize in advance for believing in you. But I would say that I have to think the Cleveland Browns scouts went back and said, there's no way we can take this guy. He's a mess. And I bet you the owners were like, nope. Colin Coward said this was a good thing to do. You know, and I'm picking on Colin Coward.
No, there's hundreds of them who played that role.
Skip Bayless. Yeah, Skip Bayless loved him. I remember that.
Yeah,
and telling everybody that they were fools to think that he wasn't. And I liked him. I didn't know all this stuff. But if I was known this stuff, I would have been like, yeah, go away. Like, there's no way. You don't want to play football. You don't have a desire. And I think that that's part of the issue, is that when you look at it from that perspective, on that one hand, then you have coaches who inherit this nightmare. And now they're like, this quarterback's going to get me fired. So the sooner I can, if he doesn't prove me wrong quickly, I need to get him out of here. And I'm ready to abandon him now, because I need to prove a point to my owner, that our GM, that it wasn't me. It was this guy screwing up. So you've got the one hand, the owners who's impatient to put him in, and on the other, and to get a guy that maybe the team didn't want. And on the other hand, you got the coach who's impatient to get him out the door when he shows it isn't working. So it's both working at odds from opposite angles to just squirt this guy out of the team, you know, just 2 points of pressure just until that's it. And I think that that's the problem, is that if they just said, look, coaches knew that they had 4 or 5 years rather than 2 or 3. If they knew they had more, then, and owners were like, I'm not going to overrule our process, and I'm going to give you a real chance, and I'm going to give you a chance to develop, I think we would see better. We'd probably see better offense, at least. And even if the teams are losing, they'd probably go, well, our offense is good. We got to shore up other parts. And we'd have a clearer eye of what we would need, what teams need to see in their draft, rather than constantly this kind of waste, because we're wasting human capital.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to kind of see what's unfolding. Before we pivot to some other positions, I do want to real quick hear your takes on two guys that I think are not out of central casting, which is why I feel like people are really honing in on, and I don't even think some of the things that people are honing in on are fully true. And I know I've heard you on some other podcasts, so I kind of want to hear you kind of elaborate a little bit. And that's, you know, Michael Panics and Bo Nix. You know, everything that comes up with them is the same thing, right? The scheme that Bo Nix played in, you know, led to a lot of his success and productivity. He doesn't do this or he doesn't do that. And then when Michael panics, it's always like, what do we hear? The same thing, right? We hear the injury concerns. We don't know about that. That, you know, that's more to medical people. But like on the football field, you hear about he doesn't have the mobility. He can't move around. And I know that's not true either, but that's what it is, so out there. And that's why I think they, you know, they're not the guys that we're talking about or publicly being talked about early in the draft, and people seem to just hone in on those areas, and I'm not even sure those areas are truly areas that should be discussed as much as they are. So a little bit, I know you like Panics. I know you like Bo Nix. What is it about them that you like? And do you think some of the things that are out there, and I'm sure you've heard some of it, now that you're all done with your own process, do you think it's a little bit just nonsensical, some of the stuff that's really being harped on these guys?
Well, I don't know other people's processes. So especially when I see things like charting passes and grading of accuracy and things like that, I really like all the things I mentioned about accuracy. I don't know if other people do. Like, there's things I know that people don't do, and sometimes it's a combination of those things. Like, maybe they look at a coverage and go, well, that was dropped, so therefore it's inaccurate, as opposed to grading that as an accurate pass at the receiver drop. I mean, there are entities that don't do that in the way I do, you know, and so maybe they miss out on players that way. So that aside, I thought Penix moved very well in the pocket. I think one of the things that gets underplayed too much by analysts that I see out there is that they'll talk about how good a player is in the pocket because he took a hit, or that he can move outside the pocket, but they don't think about how hard it is to actually climb into a pocket and work from a tight window of space and throw the ball accurately. Can they move in the pocket, find a target quickly, and throw it accurately? That's also not graded a lot. Sometimes it's just they move well in the pocket. They're accurate overall, but they don't put the things together. Like with Baker Mayfield, it was that way. I pick on Baker a lot. I'm a Browns fan. What do you want me to tell you? I didn't, you know, I wasn't a big fan of him, but I'm glad to see what's going on with him now. He's getting, you know, he's showing some better stuff with the Buccaneers, and I'm happy for him because I do root for players. But that said, you know, Baker did not climb well in the pocket. He was not accurate against tight man coverage to an NFL standard when you actually chart it. Michael Penix, on the other hand, climbs a pocket, finds the man in tight coverage over the middle, things that they say he can't do. And I saw it enough to go, those are translatable throws. Those are translatable plays. When I saw him in Indiana, same thing. I also saw that he threw the ball away when he needed to. He didn't make bad mistakes as often as a lot of the other quarterbacks did when it came to being under heavy pressure. Like, he wore like a second layer of skin at Indiana. Yeah, you know, and yeah, we saw that he can move. Saw what he can do at the combine. He can certainly move. But I think he's a smart, efficient player who doesn't get enough credit for his skills in the middle of the field. Yes, is he not, you know, the former quarterbacks who evaluate, there's a lot to learn from them. They do a great job with that. But where they err sometimes, in my opinion, is that, where I can err with certain coverage identifications that they have experience with, they can err on being too dogmatic about the coverage and how the play's supposed to go, as opposed to whether or not they made the best decision given the circumstance and not just the strict rule. Like, it's like writing. You know, there's grammar, and you can be a grammarian, and then there's like actually writing with style and with a voice that's compelling. And if you err too much on being the grammarian and everything being technically correct, you're dry and boring, and not, your points are not compelling, and you can't tell a story. You're Alex Smith. Okay. If you're on the other end of that spectrum where where maybe you can be crass and maybe a little unschooled, but everyone understands what you're saying, and your crass on school stuff is compelling, and it's entertaining, and it communicates how it needs to, you're Brett Favre, you know? And so it's one of those things that, you know, when I look at Penix, I think that people get a little too tied up and, well, he's not seeing the types of coverage he's going to see in the NFL. And I look at it and go, he's reading the type of leverage that he's going to have to show he can read in the NFL. The coverage will continue to develop. The important point isn't whether he can identify on a whiteboard a certain hybrid cover two. The important part is that when he looks at one man who's about to break open, can he see two to three defenders in the area and go, should I throw it or should I not? Because Desmond Ridder was a professor, if you listen to some, on what he did on the whiteboard. But they had to dumb down that offense, if you ask me, to make sure that he didn't throw into coverage, because on the field didn't translate. Michael Penix, to me, is more that. Bo Nix, to me, I like him. I think he's one of the safest players. He might have the, you know, compared to Jalen Daniels, compared to Drake May, compared to maybe even J.J. McCarthy, if McCarthy has the deep game, he doesn't have as high of a ceiling as those guys. And people like ceilings because they think robo quarterback, add water, magical thinking, put them on the field, they're going to figure it out. You know, that's what I think is where people err. I think Bo Nix is that guy like Matt Ryan or Kirk Cousins, where the game may not look as exciting when they come into the league, but they don't make a lot of mistakes. They know their weaknesses and don't try to go into their weaknesses. They try to veer away from them. He moves well in the pocket. He's a good athlete. He's someone that I just think overall made smart decisions. And Auburn didn't do many favors, those receivers. They dropped a lot of passes. And he plays better over the middle again and plays downfield well enough that if you're counting by sample size with quarterbacks, it's not going to look strong, but no sample size is strong enough when you're looking at some of these things that people look at. And from my experience, at least, and it's worked more often than not, even if the sample size is small, if you're looking at the right things like reading leverage, making the right decisions in terms of when to throw the ball away, when not to, how to manage a game, if you're doing those things in difficult scenarios, the sample size being smaller versus small doesn't really matter. It still translates. And for Bo Nix, I think it translates that I think he's one of those guys that could be a second contract starter, if not a first contract guy who earns a second contract again.
Yeah, I think those are two guys that if teams miss out, like, again, I think there's a lot of talk here in New York. If the Giants end up with a wide receiver at six, a lot of people think they could be, last year how the Titans moved up for Will Levis, top of the second round. I think Nix or Panix could be guys that they're looking at in that range in the top of the second round if nobody pulls the trigger on these guys, either mid-round one or late-round one. And I think they could look at these guys as guys that could step in, immediately push Daniel Jones, maybe after X amount of games, like we talked about, like, you know, if there's that period where they want him to kind of sit and learn. But I think other teams could be in that mix. I think the Raiders, you know, could be in that situation with a couple other teams if they don't have the opportunity in round one. So we'll kind of, it'll be fun. I think we'll be talking a lot of quarterbacks on the live draft show over at Football Guys in that first hour. Yeah. If, you know, I talk to Sig and I'm going to be back on, and if it's that first hour, we're going to be talking a lot of quarterbacks in that we first
might
hour.
Be, and we might, sure. Be, we might be talking about how we might be talking. I'm just going to call it now and we'll bring it up again later if you like this idea. We're going to be talking about how the Giants waited and got a quarterback that you guys wanted, or that you got probably half your fan base doesn't think you wanted, but now you're going to be happy with them. And then when Justin Jefferson demands to be traded because he's tired of playing with Drake May, the Giants are going to be in the market for him.
Yeah, we'll take it.
Yeah, as one of two really good receivers that you probably have at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's pivot over. There's two wide receivers that I really want to get to. And when I was combing through earlier the RSP a little bit, and I had a smile when I saw one of them because there's just so much negativity around them. So, like, I've been liking this player, both these players that we're going to talk about are guys that I've liked, one for a couple of years. So we'll get to that, a very under the radar one that no one's really talking about. But let's start with Keon Coleman, because I feel like the trajectory of Keon Coleman this year, I loved him last summer. All year, all I did was thought he performed and developed and performed and delivered and made highlight reel catches and was a focal point of that Florida State offense. And then we get to draft season, and it's just been basically, you know, one after another knocking on Keon Coleman's game. And I don't know if it's the Quentin Johnson effect and the Nikhil Harry effect. I feel like people have a lot of recency bias when they look at a player and they're built in that similar vein where there's some charting out there or whatever we want to call it, analytics out there that says you can't separate, and people want to kind of put everybody in the same basket. And I feel like that's where Keon Coleman has fallen in the general draft narrative out there on Draft Twitter. But I see a guy, I think some people had these concerns about T. Higgins when he was coming out, and I really liked T. Higgins. And I said, T. Higgins, and I was not a N'Keal Harry guy, but I was a T. Higgins guy. And I was like, they're totally different players. And I feel like now people are making that same generalization with Keon Coleman because maybe they were burned by Quentin Johnson. And who knows? Maybe, hopefully he turns his career around. And it was just the situation they put him in last year, and he needs some development. But I feel like people want to put that profile of a receiver all in the same basket, and they lose out on what he does bring to the table. So I kind of want, because I don't think there's a lot of people who look at Keon Coleman anymore like us. What is it about his game that really intrigues you, and why you don't have the concerns that seem to be really what has taken over Twitter and more of the mainstream draft coverage when it comes to his name?
I'm so glad that you wanted to broach this topic, because, I mean, if we weren't friendly now, before, we'd be fast friends right now just for you bringing this one up. I mean, like, I would instantly be like, just that, you know, in this industry, it's like, okay, I need to do more stuff with Paul just because he gets it. Like, to me, is there a concern that if he lands on a team with a slow processing quarterback that already has a number one on there who gets most of the volume, and he can't come back to a second read fast enough for underneath routes that Coleman might throw, and he gets relegated to being basically a end of the career Kelvin Benjamin, where you just kind of, or even any point of Kelvin Benjamin or Chase Claypool type, where he's not really targeted anymore enough to really give him the opportunities other than at the boundary? There's a concern that could happen. But honestly, when I look at him, he gets a lot of separation on timing routes. He's consistently 1 to 2 steps ahead of defenders playing tight or off man coverage of him on routes that are 15 yards and under. And he gets 1 to 2 steps on the defender. But maybe, you know, this is one of those things where I think, again, people, when they look at separation, how are they charting separation? Are they projecting it to the NFL game? Do they need to see 3 steps in the college game to say that the guy got enough separation? Or are they doing it realistically and saying, in the NFL, if he gets a half a shoulder, he's open, you know, especially if he's the first read on a timing route, you know? And I don't think anybody's dense enough who's seen Keon Coleman play to say that he can't catch a contested ball. I mean, I don't think we're there. I think we know that this dude is probably one of the best catchers of the football, in this draft class. I mean, I think if you had to throw the ball through a brick wall and hope that someone would burst through and catch it, Keon Coleman might be my first choice to be like the impossible obstacle. We need to save the world with the impossible play versus the impossible obstacle. Who am I going to pick? I go, yeah, Keon Coleman. I'll take Keon Coleman. Because that's basically, he's our best chance for that level of success. So to me, I think you can play all 3 spots. I've seen some people mention some things I've mentioned online on Twitter recently, which was, whenever asked about him, I say, have you seen the dude return punts at Florida State? Because this is why I joke that he's the LeGarrette Blunt of wide receivers. He's not getting any respect for what he actually does as a receiver. He's much quicker and much more efficient with his movement than you would expect for a player who ran a 4.61. I don't care about the 4.61. I care about whether he gets early separation, whether he can maintain that separation, whether he can win the ball and he can run a good route. Because it's not how fast you run, it's how fast you stop. How fast can you stop? He stops really fast. He can run at full speed, and he can open his hips and turn at a 90-degree angle without extra steps. That's running back stuff. That's starting NFL running back stuff. That translates to route running. So does the weight, the dropping of his weight into a chair and being able to come back to the ball, which he does really well too. So for me, I just look at him, and the only issue I see is if he gets labeled a limited kind of contributor by their team immediately that doesn't know what they have, and they just put them in this little typecasted role. It's like if they took, you know, Lawrence Fishburne and said, we're just going to make you a thug in like every movie. And then when you get too old, we're going to make you a homeless bum. And we're just going to do that. You know, we're not going to let you be anything else. Those are the two roles you have. And if you can somehow survive on that, good for you. But that's all we're going to do. Man, he plays a mean bum. He plays a mean thief. You know, I mean, that's where I worry about Keon Coleman is that the team says, well, he's a possession boundary receiver who we just throw the ball up for grabs for him. And that's it, where he could be more, like you said, T. Higgins, Mike Williams, ask where, yes, they do those things, but they also do more than that.
Yeah, I'd love to see him in Buffalo. Buffalo would be like the spot where that would be like home run, catapulted dynasty stock. Like, let's get it happening, like the end of round one.
Yes.
Buffalo might be double dipping in wide receiver this year. You know, they gotta definitely, and this is the draft to probably do it too, because there's a lot of guys and a lot of body types. So let's pivot to another guy, and we're not going to hear his name probably today, Bree, of the NFL draft, but I've been talking about him here at Saturday Sunday for, I think, at least three full years now, and that's Aeneas Smith out of Texas A&M. One of my, people love using that term, my guys, he's been one of my guys for 3 years, and I just kept waiting for him to get to the NFL, and then, like, for whatever reason, there was an injury, I believe, the year before. You know, and then there's been some ups and downs, but all I do is every time I watch his film and take out the stuff that overcomes Twitter, like market share and this and that and all this other analytics stuff, that as a math teacher, I'm just like, no, don't really care about it when I'm talking about evaluating football players. Like, all I do is see Aeneas Smith make plays, his versatility, you know, And better route running than people want to give him credit for. People want to just pigeonhole him to be a guy who is just a manufactured touch player as a returner, a jet sweep guy. But I think there's a legitimate route running chops there too. And I think you even have him higher than I have him in your overall ranks at the wide receiver board. You know, so I kind of want to open the floor of what is it about his game that has you intrigued? What is it about him that clearly you see about him to have him where you have him ranked in a very strong wide receiver draft class?
What's your address so that I can just email you like a 12 pack of your favorite beer just for bringing up two of my favorite players to talk about? That, I mean, we didn't do a show sheet or script anything with this. I had no idea you were going to bring up.
I have an Excel spreadsheet for myself where I just kind of jotted down, you know, some of your rankings that stood out, and then highlighted. The only two names highlighted on the entire sheet are Keon Coleman and Aeneas Smith. Yeah. No matter what happened in this show, I wasn't letting you leave until Keon Coleman and Aeneas Smith were talked about, which is why I went to wide receiver before we're going to hit the running backs. I was like, oh, we'll do that last, because I could always cut guys out that I might want it. I was like, we're not leaving. We're not Matt talking about these two. Yeah.
Aeneas Smith may not get drafted because of the off-field stuff. You know, he has the ACL tear, so that probably would drop him a little bit, even though he's healthy all last year. He did have shin surgery recently. But, you know, that might have dropped him a round or two, I would estimate, just because he's had the history of that. But then the arrest with three charges of driving while intoxicated, which was the biggie, the marijuana possession charge, which is just an iffy judgment, and then the gun possession that's unlicensed firearm in Texas, also immaturity. Okay. Those things can be addressed. The DWI is the biggie. That may drop him lower out of the draft. But if you put that aside, I kept watching him too, because I remember him as Isaiah Spiller's, you know, co-starter running back. He was kind of Mr. Outside, who didn't always make great decisions inside when they put him inside, but in space, he looked great. We knew we could catch the ball reasonably well, for sure. But we didn't really know until they moved him to wide receiver, and you start watching him and you're like, this guy looks like he's been playing wide receiver. He was looked like he was recruited as a wide receiver. And so, you know, the route running is sharp. He has a variety of breaks. He knows how to set defenders up with his stems. He has some release work that I think is going to get better. He's a sound technician from basically release through break. And that's not a lot of these guys can say that, even if they're talented. And then catching the ball, he makes a lot of tough catches. I mean, not just catches against contact or tight coverage, but adjustments to the ball, like low digging out of throws away from his frame, high throws, boundary targets, full layouts of targets. I mean, like saving his quarterback's bacon repeatedly, where he's basically erasing inaccurate throws and does it like he's a 7-year veteran in the NFL. All I could think about was like Derek Mason when I watching him catching the football and running routes, who, you know, was a, what, 16-year veteran or 14-year veteran in the NFL, and was seemed like he got better as the years passed for a while. So I'm watching all that, but then I'm watching him after the catch, and and you're like, he's one of the best runners after the catch in this class. I mean, he breaks tackles, he bounces off hits, he has excellent skill at being able to set up defenders in the open field, whether there's a blocker he's setting up into or it's unblocked, and he's got to make the man miss or make him lose his angle of pursuit. He does all those things really well. And so I start looking at him more, and I'm like, this guy's more of a Curtis Samuel, Golden Tate type of player, and leaning more towards Golden Tate for me. Whereas like Curtis Samuel, we knew he could catch. We saw that at Ohio State, and he made receiver-like adjustments, but he wasn't the route runner that he needed to be at that point. When I watch Golden Tate, though, I remember Golden Tate was that running back who they moved to receiver, and you're like, this dude's a wide receiver. I was like, this dude can, there's some route skill, there's some real good hand work, there's some way to attack and position. And I think Anaya Smith might be a better route runner at this stage of his career than Golden Tate was, but their trajectories could be very similar, which is wind up being Pro Bowl caliber slot receivers who can also play outside at flanker when you need them to. So yeah, Anaya Smith to me is the free chip you're getting at the end of probably most drafts, who I'm taking every time if I get a chance. To get him, because he's one of my favorites in terms of just skills, and the opportunity is a low risk investment because no one's counting on him to do anything if he doesn't have any draft capital.
Yeah, and in a class that is so deep at wide receiver, and for people who do this a little bit here or there and get into it after the NFL season, he's not even going to be on people's general lists to look at. And like what you just talked about, like for years I said, like, after the catch, the only one, like, after the catch, he's Kadarius Toney, but he doesn't have any of the other things that made Kadarius Toney inconsistent. Yeah. But after the catch, his movement skills, his ability to bounce off contact and pick up yards after contact, like, that was, like, Kadarius Toney's special skill. He's got that special skill in Ia Smith, but he actually has route running, you know, maybe the off-the-field stuff, maybe their decision-making, they're about the same too, but hopefully not, and hopefully he fixes it. You know, hopefully he has a more of a love for the game, which I think part of Tony's issues is never really having a love for the football. But he's a guy that I'm so fascinated where he goes, because, you know, he might, I think I'm right on this, right? Way back when you had Isaiah Crowell really high on your running back rankings.
Number one.
Okay. I think that might have been like one of the first years I really dug into the RSP. And like, what did he went? Did he go undrafted, or he went in the seventh round?
He went undrafted by the Browns, and they picked the kid from Towson, I think. No, they had Deion Lewis, and they had Jamal Lewis still, I think, too. And both those guys got hurt in the preseason. They were about to cut Crowell because they didn't even let him get reps. And then they put him at the end of a third preseason game, and he played well enough that he wound up the starter down the line.
Yeah. And I think that could be a situation here that we find Anaya Smith in. Does he get that opportunity? Because if he gets a legitimate opportunity, I think his skill set is going to shine. It does some of the circumstances that he put it, that he did on his own, you know, some of his own poor decision making. But if he gets that opportunity, and if we're just talking skills on a football field, I think he's going to be a guy that surprises, and nobody's talking about him anywhere.
Skills on the football field, just based on my grade of him, he would have been my number four player wide receiver in the 2022 class. He would have been my number two receiver in last year's class with the grade. He's 11th on my board in this class, which again, rankings don't matter to me as much as grades. So the fact that he's in, you know, it's not that he's 11th that matters to me. It matters to a lot of people, but it's the fact that he's a top of tier two wide receiver with an instant starter grade. Like in the right scenario, he should, where he gets an opportunity, he has the ability to perform like a starter. That's how deep this class could be, you know, if it works out.
It's going to be fun to kind of see if he gets that opportunity. Let's use this player as the wide receiver to running back pivot, because he was a former wide receiver. And I'm talking about Tyrone Tracy Jr. out of Purdue, a guy that doesn't have a lot of running back snaps to his game. So maybe a little bit just right there as we talk about him, the player, is there enough for him? Like, it's such a limited rushing attempts. Is it harder to make a full evaluation that you're used to? Or is it enough that, you know, you go by what you have, even though he doesn't have years at that position? So maybe a little bit about that with your process, and then a little bit about Tyrone Tracy and maybe deployment usage at the next level, what you think he could bring to a team.
I think it's enough, because really we're not, there are only certain types of schemes that players can run in as a running back compared to the number of routes that they could possibly run or target scenarios that they face as wide receivers. So when you watch him as a running back, if he struggles with, say, gap man blocking, where it's pulling blockers or duo, where, you know, it's not a zone, you're picking one crease essentially to hit, and you're having trouble showing patience with those, or when you are running an occasional zone play and you bounce plays outside that you shouldn't, you've seen enough. You know, there are times where it could have just been a bad decision. But if you see like in three games, 3 to 4 bad decisions, you know, and the only time that they run those, you go, he needs more experience with that, and he needs to learn how to do that, and he's not familiar with it. So that's just work ahead. So when I look at Tyrone Tracy, yeah, I thought there was enough, and I saw him as a kind of a Kenyon Drake, aspiring Kenyon Drake, you know, and where Kenyon Drake was to begin his career, maybe not even as far along as Kenyon Drake was. Kenyon Drake could catch, and, you know, Tyrone Tracy doesn't catch as well, even, and that's probably why he was moved to running back, because he clap attacks a lot of footballs where he's not getting his hands in position, and he fights the ball as a result or misses it completely in certain situations that he really shouldn't. He does bounce too many plays. He doesn't really understand how to always be as patient as he needs to be. He is strong for his size. He's definitely fast. He's definitely got the quickness you're looking for. He has all the physical tools you're looking for from a running back, and the size to boot to develop into probably a 5'11", 215-pound runner. That's what he could probably get to, with explosion and just more nuance to his game, and could give you a little bit of that check down screen game leak type of work as a receiver. And he's very good in the open field. For me, though, he is at the borderline of a contributor and a reserve. Like, he's essentially a guy that if you give him a certain set of plays per game, really just geared towards setting him up for success, getting him into open space or surprising the defense so that there's a big enough crease, then I think he can give you some production in those roles. If you ask him to be the lead back, I think you're going to see a lot of mistakes conceptually from his game that could also lead to mistakes on the field that are turnovers or stuffed plays and that kind of thing. And he needs a little bit of time to really understand how to play the running back position.
Yeah, he's going to be one of those guys that, like, once upon a time when there was like one running back on a team and not a committee or usage, like, he probably gets lost in the shuffle. Now with the way teams want to use multiple backs, three backs, like four backs, like, you know, like would we all be surprised if Miami says in the fifth round or whatever, like, let's get another guy who's fast and athletic and just kind of add him to the mix here, you know, and make him wait in the wings, you know, to be part of that running back group. Like we're San Francisco, right? Same idea, like same, you know, same type
Elijah
of.
Elijah Mitchell. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like I could totally see him going a little bit. Teams are intrigued by obviously speed. We always know that. Like, and just like they're not always looking for the guy who could be like, okay, carry 18 times or carry 16 times. So I think he could be a guy that goes a little bit higher than maybe, you know, people expect because of that and because of the allure of, oh, he's still new to the position. There's still maybe more growth there. So it'd be interesting to kind of see his, where he lands on draft weekend. Let's go the other way. Let's go right to the tippy top here. Jonathan Brooks at Texas. While he's at most people's or near most people's top of their running back board, I do feel like it's been a little out of sight, out of mind with the injury and, you know, no pro day and no combine. So, like, I don't feel like he's being talked about as much as normally one of the top running backs in the draft class would be. And I know people are genuinely a little down on this class as a whole, but I also do think him being out of sight, out of mind is probably aided in that lack of people talking about. What is it about him that puts him at the top of your ranks and really has your process putting him as the guy that you like the most?
He's smooth. He's a smart decision maker who understands how to get the most out of a play, whether it's a scripted situation that's well structured and blocked or a poorly blocked play that he has to go off script. He's mature about how he handles his things. He has really refined footwork and really understands how to get himself in and out of trouble, or really get himself out of trouble and get himself into favorable situations. So he processes the field very fast. It looks to me like he's moving at a different speed than other players around him because he's processing quickly. He's powerful for his size. He initiates contact and runs through a lot of it. And I think he attacks well so that he's not taking the brunt of the punishment as a result of that. He's the best pass protector in this class, if you ask me. I think that he really does understand how to strike, and that means he can strike defenders his size and even a little bit bigger and hold up at least reasonably well for what you'd expect for that position in scenarios where he has to take on bigger men. Good receiver out of the backfield. If you ask me, based on his grade, even including the injury that we're have to mark off for the injury, he would have been the number two running back in the class last year. And that means that, you know, when we're looking at Bijan Robinson and Jahmyr Gibbs, that means Jahmyr Gibbs would have been just a very close number three. That tells you how good this kid can be. We'll see if he gets that opportunity.
Yeah, he's a guy who, like, you know, the fantasy world's going to go bonkers if he ends up in Dallas just because of the giant opening that currently resides in their backfield. But, you know, for me, him and Trey Benson are my two guys at the top. Really, really like both of those guys. But I just feel like a lot of people seem like they're talking about Benson. But I just feel like Jonathan Brooks is not getting the attention. And I know the NFL likes him, and he's going to go as one of either the first or second running back, probably off the board if the medicals are okay. But, you know, it's just something that, like, I feel like we so get enamored with the pre-draft cycle and the pre-draft months that it's so easy to forget about how good of a player he is, which I want to use that as my pivot to the last guy we'll talk about today. And I think the buzz around him was much higher earlier in his collegiate career. And I think that's partially just because Clemson kind of fell on hard times over the last, you know, a couple of years here compared to where obviously they were when they were legit in the national title picture every year. I really like Will Shipley's game, and I think he's a guy that people seem to be genuinely down on. You don't see him in many top fives, top sevens, top eights, even top tens. Some people don't have him in. What is it about Will Shipley? I saw that he was inside your top 10. What do you like about his game? Do you think he could be a guy that could just be like a part of a committee? Could he lead a committee? What do you kind of envision maybe Will Shipley could be at the next level and his best attributes?
Well, I mean, I think his best attribute that people know, obviously, is that he is a strong route runner and pass receiver. And that's where he's going to get a lot of opportunities, at least initially, is in the passing game, especially in the 2-minute offense or 5-minute offense, where he's used in that way to get in the space. He's very shifty. He's quick. He's someone that has good short area change of direction and decision making, and he can work his way out of trouble. Just where, like, Travis Etienne was a little bit overrated, in my opinion, because he was a function of a really strong Clemson offense where he didn't have to process as much difficult things. And when he was faced with processing difficult scenarios, he failed. And that was something that he was going to have to work on. And we saw that the difference between year one and year two, or year two and year three with him, was that he became a better processor. He became better with his pads. You saw that at Clemson, you could see the potential for him to learn that, and that he was showing signs of turning the corner, but wasn't fully there. And that continued to be the case early on in his career, but he's starting to do that and look more like an all-around runner. But Shipley got the opposite of that, where the offense wasn't good around him. So as a result, he faced more difficult scenarios. And because he wasn't, you know, because people don't look at processing for running backs, they think running backs are instinctive. They like to call them instinctive. But the one thing that we have learned about processing that Rick Spielman talked about, the former GM, a few years ago, is that, listen, the closer you are aligned to the middle of the field to begin a play, the more demand there are on you to be a good processor of information. Well, what's more in the middle of the field than the center, quarterback, and running back in most cases? Running backs are underrated because they have to be good processors. And Will Shipley is a good processor of information who was on a bad team. So as a result of that, he's getting downplayed in a way that he doesn't need to be. And I see him as kind of at worst, like right now, I think he's like Bilal Powell, like a veteran who can start for you if you need be, but maybe not quite as physical as you want him to be, but he can do everything reasonably well enough to get volume if you need it. And if he can continue to grow into the position, maybe he can be more dynamic than what Bilal Powell was. And now we're talking about, you know, Austin Ekeler or Kenny Irons. If you remember Kenny Irons at Auburn before he came to the NFL and promptly got hurt and his career was done. But he could be in that range. So I'm open to that idea.
Yeah, this running back class is really one of those things where it kind of has a little bit of everything, and it's being downplayed a little bit. But I think some of these guys, I don't think we might not see any in the top 50. I think that's probably most likely the outcome on draft weekend. But I do think when you get to that late portion of round two or in round three, we're going to see a little bit of a blitz on four or five guys go. And I think you're going to see some really good value in the fourth round of the NFL draft with some of these running backs, and some teams are going to get some really good players like Will Shipley and, you know, and other guys in that round four mix, maybe some even fall to round five. And you know, because the wide receiver class is so good, the offensive line group is so good. Like, you have a lot of quarterbacks that are going to, yeah,
the man.
Exactly. So it's going to be something where, you know, for the fantasy people only who really dive into that, it is going to be a little bit tricky, I think, with the whole running back situation. It's like, how do you invest a guy? He's a day three pick. We know that the leash sometimes is really short on those, even when we think we find the guy, right? Like, you know, Michael Carter, and then the somebody like that, and then the Jets draft over him, like, the following year or whatever, when they get an opportunity to get a guy like Breece Hall. So for the fantasy output, I think it'll be a little tricky with those guys. I think teams are going to find really interesting guys that have a role and a value on the NFL world in terms of a depth chart. And some of these guys on day three are going to morph into starters or leads of a committee. And I think there's going to be a lot of different guys that kind of come to the forefront. Matt, absolutely always a pleasure to do this with you. I thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to hanging out with you and Sig for the draft in a couple of weeks, and then obviously have you come back on sometime post-draft. We can dig into some of these guys more and now tie them to some landing spots and scheme fits and stuff like that. But thank you again, as always, for coming on.
Hey, it's an absolute pleasure, and you can find me at mattwaldman.com if you guys want to check out the RSP. Appreciate it.
Guys, please, I'm sure most of my listeners purchase it, but it's the best. It is the best. I say it every year. It's Matt's work. It's Dane Brugler's The Beast. It's the best two. If you have just those two draft publications, you're ready to go for draft weekend and everything that comes with it. So make sure you get over there, check out all Matt's great work, the videos, all his, you know, his RSP stuff, the film room, the podcast, all that stuff he does. Make sure you check it all out. So on behalf of Matt, on behalf of our sound tech engineer, David Nakano, and myself, thank you for joining us. And we look forward next time taking you from Saturday to Sunday.